6-2973, Jane Himberger versus Joanne Bitzer et al. Representing Joanne Bitzer is Michael Model.
May it please the court, my name is Mike Model. I represent the appellants who are defendants in the action below. The issue is, what is the appropriate statute of limitation in a claim brought pursuant to 42 U.S.C. section 1983 in state court? There's really no dispute as to the several key facts. The plaintiff was terminated from employment in May of 1989. More than 4 years after termination from employment, she brought a First Amendment claim. There are two statutes that the parties essentially agree. I don't agree which one applies, but two that will have application. One is section 893.53. That's the statute injury to character and other rights. And the second is section 893.54, injury to the person. If the three-year statute of limitations in section 893.54 applies, plaintiff's claims are barred. If the six-year limitation period in 893.53 applies, then the claims are timely. Parties also agree that there basically are two U.S. Supreme Court cases that are critical to the court's analysis. Those are Wilson v. Garcia and Owens v. Acura. And the final decision probably that's significant to the court is the Wisconsin decision v. Hansen. It's a Court of Appeals decision. In Wilson, the United States Supreme Court changed the analysis for determining what is the appropriate statute of limitation in a Section 1983 case. The Wilson court held that a simple and broad characterization of all 1983 claims is required. And in deciding that, the Wilson court held that it is the personal injury statute of limitation of each state that controls. The reason was the court wanted a statute of general application. The law had been confusing, the law had been complex as to which limitation period applied to various claims. If you had an excessive force claim, was it a intentional tort kind of battery claim? Was it some kind of a rights claim? So rather than tie the statute of limitation to the specific alleged wrong, the Supreme Court said, let's make this simple. One statute of limitation will apply, and that's personal injury. In selecting the personal injury statute of limitation, the interest of the court was to pick a limitation period that was general and broad, and to pick a limitation period that covered a major portion of civil litigation in the state. And the reason was the Supreme Court's concern that federal rights be protected. If a more limited statute of limitation was selected, the concern was that a state legislature could change that statute of limitation without affecting a broad class of cases. In Owens, the United States Supreme Court looked at the issue again of statute of limitations in a 1983 action. They in no way retreated from the analysis that personal injury statute of limitation is what the courts should be applying. They also in no way retreated from the analysis as to why. What occurred in the Owens case is there's an intentional tort statute of limitation and then general personal injury statute of limitation. In that circumstance, the Supreme Court held that it's the general or residual statute of limitation covering personal injury actions that applies. The Supreme Court in Owens, to give guidance to lower courts, said you should look to the language and the application of the particular statutes to determine which is the appropriate personal injury statute of limitation. If we look at the language of the two statutes at issue here, section 893.54, by its terms, the title of the statute is injury to the person. Clearly, the personal injury statute of limitation. The language of the statute also references injury to the person, personal injury statute of limitation. The reason the court wanted statutes for personal injuries, again, they wanted to make the process simple. If we look in the revisor of the statutes, if we look at this volume of the statute here under index, we looked at personal injury, you'd see in the index the word action under personal injury, then you'd see the word limitation, and there's a cite to one statute, and that is 893.54. That's simple for anyone who's trying to determine, knowing that personal injury statute of limitation applies, which one it is. A significant amount of Section 1983 claims are brought by pro se litigants. So it'd make it simple for pro se litigants as well. They understand it has to be brought within a personal injury limitation period. Define that period. Application of the statute is another issue that the Supreme Court said a court should look at in determining what's the proper statute of limitation. We want a statute, the Supreme Court said, that has broad application, that covers a major portion of the civil litigation in the state. Well, that's what we have with Section 893.54.
You could say the same thing about 53 in the sense that it certainly covers more than personal injury. It covers personal injury and others. In other words, wouldn't that be the broadest? And that's the interpretation, of course, that the Seventh Circuit gave us also, and that's dealing with the civil rights with the 1983 type litigation. So how do you answer that? I mean, this seems to be broader, and it seems to be consistent with what is required under both Wilson and Owens.
Sure. I don't believe that it may be broader. It depends on how we define what is a character right, what is an other right. It's difficult to tell whether it's broader, but even assuming that it is, the instruction from the United States Supreme Court was to apply the personal injury statute of limitation, not to pick necessarily the broadest statute that's out there. Again, the concern for the Supreme Court was, let's find the statute that covers the major portion of a major portion of civil litigation, because that's a statute that a legislature is unlikely to change, because it would not, that would prejudice so many pending state cases. So the fact that arguably point 893.53 may be broader, I don't believe that makes it the appropriate statute of limitation.
Mr. Mortal, wasn't the Supreme Court in Owens looking at which statute would be the general or residual personal injury statute?
Correct. It was looking at the issue as whether the intentional tort statute of limitation for that particular state or a general personal injury statute of limitation applied.
And didn't it opt for the general one?
It opted for the general over the intentional, correct.
The language in 893.53 talks about it covering an injury to the character or rights of another, not arising on contract, and then goes on to say, except where a different period is expressly prescribed. Wouldn't that language, especially the last language I read, strengthen very much the argument that this is the residual statute, the general and residual statute?
What we have to remember is it's not simply a residual statute of limitation. It's the general or personal injury residual. It's general or residual personal injury statute of limitation. 893.53 is part of that subchapter on torts. It's not necessarily even a personal injury statute of limitation. 893.54, clearly is a personal injury statute of limitation.
Well, we're not bound, obviously, in this situation by the federal decisions. But isn't Justice Wilcox correct that not only has the Seventh Circuit, but also both district courts, federal district courts of Wisconsin, found that the residual statute in regard to personal injury is 893.53?
I don't believe the Eastern District had found that prior to Gray v. Lackey. And there was a split in the decisions in the Western District prior to Gray v. Lackey. Once the Seventh Circuit decided Gray v. Lackey, I don't believe that either district court had a choice. I don't believe that at that point they could disregard mandatory precedent. The legislative history also indicates that Section 893.54 is Wisconsin's personal injury, and that's both general and residual statute of limitation. In the brief and in the appendix to the opening brief of the appellants, that analysis is set forth in detail, so I'm not going to go through that, but what is significant is that originally 893.53 and .54 were in one statute, and when the legislature amended that statute in 1957 and split that statute up, they put into .54 those provisions specifically dealing with personal injury, and they did not put any comparable language into 893.53.
Can you tell me, and this wasn't argued in the briefs, but can you tell me why the language is different in 53 than 54 in terms of the identity of the injured party? In 893.54 sub 1, it reads, an action to recover damages for injuries to the person. And 53 is an action to recover damages for an injury to the right of another. Is that significant? It's not to the person? And this may have nothing to do with anything, but I just noticed that the language is different in the two statutes, and I wonder if that was significant.
I'm not certain what significance that may have, Your Honor. I think clearly action to recover damages for injury to the person is what the Supreme Court was getting at in both Wilson and in Owen v. Okora. It said personal injury is the appropriate statute of limitation.
So you read injuries to the person to mean personal injuries?
Yes, Your Honor.
But you certainly could have used person in 53, too, the character or rights of a person. But anyway, we don't know. There's nothing, you didn't find anything in legislative history that explained that.
I did not. The controlling case law in Wisconsin also supports that 893.54 is Wisconsin's personal injury statute of limitation. The Hansen decision was decided approximately 1 month after the United States Supreme Court decided Wilson v. Garcia. In Hansen, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals held that the appropriate statute of limitation for a Section 1983 action brought in state court is 3 years, and that three-year period was the period set forth in Section 893.54. The question is, what is Wisconsin's personal injury statute of limitation? And the court in Hansen, our Wisconsin Court of Appeals, held the appropriate statute of limitation for personal injury is Section 893.54. I don't believe the Owens case changed that analysis in any significant way, at least not had the Hansen decision decided that the Wisconsin's intentional tort statute of limitation in 893.57 had been the appropriate limitation period. Clearly, Owens would have affected that, but that was not the holding. The plaintiff is asking this court to overrule the Hansen decision, and there are no grounds to do so. Wisconsin courts have also repeatedly, in discussing statutes of limitation and in talking about personal injuries, referenced Section 893.54 as that the statute of limitation for personal injury actions in Wisconsin. And those citations are set forth at pages 21 through 24 of the appellant's brief, and there's a string cite setting forth the language of the courts. To my knowledge, no court in Wisconsin has expressly held or expressly considered the issue as to what is Wisconsin's general personal injury statute of limitation or residual personal injury statute of limitation. However, the cases cited at 21 to 24 are those cases in which the courts refer to 893.54 as either Wisconsin's general personal injury statute of limitation or Wisconsin's personal injury statute of limitation. There doesn't seem to be an argument by the plaintiff that 893.54 is Wisconsin's general personal injury statute of limitation. The argument appears to be that it's Wisconsin's residual personal injury statute of limitation, and that creates a conflict, that we have 893.54 as general and 893.53 as residual. The United States Supreme Court said there is one general or residual statute of limitation in a state. There is no question that 893.54 is that general statute of limitation. To the extent that there is a question as to what is the residual personal injury statute of limitation, not tort generally, but personal injury, this court should look at the analysis and the factors that were important to the Supreme Court in adopting a personal injury statute of limitation in the first instance. And that those were, you want a simple statute of limitation, one that's easily understood so there's no confusion. People looking at the statute, looking at this in the statutory index, will see that 893.54 is that simple statute of limitation covering personal injuries. The other broad...
What about 893.55? Isn't that a personal injury statute also? It's a medical malpractice statute, but it certainly relates to injury to person, does it not?
Yes, I would agree that that's a personal injury statute of limitation.
So obviously 893.33 and 893.54 are not the only personal injury statutes.
Oh, correct, Your Honor. The state can have more than one personal injury type statute of limitation.
How do you suggest then we get to which one is general or residual? Because isn't that what Owens really tells us to do?
Sure. The general is by the language of the statute saying that injuries or actions for injuries to the person are to be brought under 893.54 in 3 years. The language of the various courts that have spoken and stated 893.54 is Wisconsin's general statute of limitation. I disagree that 893.53 is even necessarily a personal injury statute of limitation. Clearly, it's under the tort section of the subsection of the statutes on limitations. It certainly is deals with torts, and it likely is a residual statute dealing with torts, but not necessarily with personal injuries. And that was the focus that the United States Supreme Court said courts are to look at.
And what's the injury here?
The injury in this case, it was a First Amendment retaliation claim, termination on based exercising First Amendment rights.
So you view that as a personal injury? I mean, is that the way we usually think about that?
I don't, Your Honor.
Or is it like an injury to the character or rights of another?
I don't believe that the United States Supreme Court in either Wilson or in Owens was saying that we're trying to look at the nature of the claim. Is this the nature of an excessive...
Suppose this was a state claim, not a 1983. What statute would apply?
I'm not sure what the state claim is. For wrongful termination?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Wrongful termination. Even an employee at will, wrongful termination in violation of First Amendment rights.
I'm not certain, but I think there is a specific statute dealing with employment terminations on wrongful discharge of public policy claim. I think it's a 6-year contract type claim. It doesn't fall under either 0.53 or 0.54. But in addressing the court's first question, I don't believe the United States Supreme Court was attempting to characterize particular claims, saying this Fourth Amendment excessive force claim is a personal injury claim, this termination for failing to give proper due process is a personal injury claim. It appears that the Supreme Court was saying, what is a simple way to characterize all 1983 claims for purposes of statute of limitation? The plaintiff suggests in her brief that a 3-year statute of limitation would impermissibly shorten, is an impermissibly short statute of limitation and somehow would burden federal rights. 3 years clearly is an adequate time period to bring a claim, whether it's a federal claim or a state claim.
But she, if she brought this in federal court, she'd be okay, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. Had this claim been brought in federal court, it would have been timely.
Nick, and that's the question I have when you talk about to eliminate confusion, going back to my first question. The confusion would be, well, you've got a different statute of limitations. You're in the Seventh Circuit, same question, it's 6 years. You come to the state of Wisconsin, and you're dealing with 3 years. So wouldn't the argument be to eliminate the confusion that you would go with the same time limit? Your argument, of course, is that, well, we have Hansen, and under the stare decisis, we should stick with it. But based on the confusion argument, for the elimination of confusion, it would seem to me that that would be a better position if one were to say that's what the federal is.
In addition to the stare decisis argument, the Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit made a decision without looking at legislative history. They made a decision that's certainly not binding on this court. If this court, looking at the issue as to what is the appropriate statute of limitation, looking at the language of the statute, looking at the legislative history, looking at Wisconsin case law under these statutes, decides that the appropriate statute of limitation, because it is Wisconsin's general personal injury statute of limitation, is section 893.54, it's the appellant's contention that that decision is one of pure state law. What's Wisconsin's general statute of limitation? And the federal courts, absent a decision from the United States Supreme Court, would be compelled to follow that decision, and there would be the consistency and the lack of confusion. The other argument that ties into the last question that the plaintiff makes is that having a 3-year statute of limitation in Wisconsin will create a forum, issue of forum shopping. We know right now that state and federal courts have concurrent jurisdiction over Section 1983 claims. A plaintiff can, in a sense, forum shop if he or she chooses by bringing her action originally in state court or federal court, and we know that because it's a Section 1983 claim, is a federal claim, that a defendant can remove that to federal court as long as they do so timely within the 30-day time period. So forum shopping is, I believe, a non-issue, and I'm not sure that this is even forum shopping. The right of removal, we know, is so strong based on the Quinley case that's cited in the appellant's reply brief, that in that case, the state and the federal courts in the state of Ohio had different statutes of limitation, and the federal court had a shorter statute of limitation than the federal court ruled that the limitation period was shorter than what the state court had ruled. In that case, the plaintiff brought the case in state court where he had the longer limitation period. Defendant removed it to federal court where there is a shorter limitation period, and the case was barred. In our situation, until the law would be made consistent, that would never happen. If a plaintiff brought a case in state court, if the claim was 4 years old, like this claim, a plaintiff's on notice that Hansen is out there, and Hansen says that you have to bring it within 3 years or it's barred. If it's 4 years, you bring it in federal court. And there's no concern that a defendant could remove a case in federal court, as in that Quinley case, and bar the plaintiff's claim. There are no other questions?
Well, I have one, and I'm going to ask the other party also. Owen says that, it's been read enough times, I don't need to read it to you. The question I have is, what personal injury action in the state of Wisconsin would not be covered by 893.54, personal injury?
A medical malpractice case now would not be covered by .54 because there's a specific statute that covers that. Certain intentional torts that could lead to personal injury, a battery action, would be covered by 893.57, which is a 2-year statute of limitation. I don't have 893 in front of me with the tort section, that subsection, but I believe there are probably two or three others. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Stewart, representing Jane Hamburger.
May it please the court. My name is Stephen Score. I represent the plaintiff respondent, Jane Hamburger. One of the few things that I remember from law school 20 years after having graduated is a professor in criminal law stating, first semester, first year of law school, that the meaning of a term can vary greatly, the same word, depending upon how it is used, in what context, and when it was used. At the time, that wasn't a surprising statement because we all know language and words can be used differently. But the significance of that at that time was that with law, the use of words is so critical in terms of expressing meaning and principles that the use of words can be the basis upon which cases turn. This case brought that back to me because the term personal injury or injury to personal rights is what it is issue here, and what is the meaning of that term. The defendant's argument rests on a fairly simple syllogism, which in essence says the term used by the Supreme Court in one sense is the same term as used by the Wisconsin legislature in another sense. The major premise of the syllogism is that the Supreme Court in Wilson and Owens was talking about personal injuries. The minor premise is 89354 mentions the term personal injuries. The conclusion is that they draw is, since personal injuries is the same term, it means the same thing, and therefore the three-year statute applies. In Wilson, however, the focus of the court and the essence of the court's decision was an injury to personal rights. That was what the case was trying to do. It was trying to analyze for purposes of section, what is a section 1983 case? What does it involve? What is its essence? Its essence is an injury to personal rights, not just an injury to person. And this is reflected by a couple of different comments, and it's also reflected by the actual language of section 1983. The language of section 93 doesn't mention personal injury at all. What it mentions is a deprivation of the rights, privileges, or immunities secured by the Constitution and laws. And in Wilson, Justice Stevens is using personal injury, the term personal injury, interchangeably with injury to personal rights. And this is reflected by, on page 277, when Justice Stevens talks about the 14th Amendment and how the 14th Amendment is tied to section 1983. He says, a violation of that command is an injury to the individual rights of the person. On page 278, Justice Stevens continued, had the 42nd Congress expressly focused on the issue decided today, we believe it would have characterized section 1983 as conferring a general remedy for injuries to personal rights. And if you turn to Owens, what Justice Marshall was talking about is Justice Marshall again re-emphasized the idea that what you're talking about is not a, quote, personal injury per se, but an injury to rights. Now let's flip to 89354, because here's where the analysis becomes critical. When the legislature used injuries to person in 89354, what did it mean? The answer is supplied in the case cited by the defendants, Koshnick versus Schmeckel. That case involved the negligent use of a medical report in a medical malpractice case. What Justice Day wrote in that opinion, and I'm citing 96 with second 151, and it was within the last several years. He wrote, in Klingbeil versus Sossaman, and he gives a cite, which I'll talk about in a minute, it's a 1917 case of this court. It was noted that the injuries, that the words, action to recover damage or injury to the person, means an action brought on account of or by reason of bodily injuries inflicted upon a human being. Bodily injuries. And in Klingbeil, it's interesting, this court was construing the predecessor of 89353 and 89354 when it was one statute. What it was saying is injuries to the person means bodily injuries. Once we understand that, then it all makes sense. 89353 is a bodily injury statute. That's the way it's been construed. That's the way it's been used. That's what the courts have used it for. 893.53 is a broader statute dealing with an injury to rights in a much broader sense, a much more general sense, and in a residual sense.
What about emotional damage?
If there's bodily injury, if emotional damage flows from the bodily injury, then 893.54 applies. If there's just emotional distress, I would argue 893.53 applies. And if you look at, and I can't think of any case just off the top of my head in terms of that, but intentional interference with contract, I don't know whether that would involve an emotional distress kind of injury or not, that's under 893.53. Legal malpractice is 893.53. Professional malpractice, not involving bodily injuries, is 893.53. So, once you understand that the Supreme Court is using the term personal injury in terms of injuries to rights, the Wisconsin legislature is using the term personal injury in 893.54 in terms of bodily injuries, it becomes clear that the applicable statute here, clear that the applicable statute here is 893.53. And actually, I'd like to read from Judge Crabb's opinion in the Cadena case, which is decided in 1985. And she points this out. And I'll just read a brief portion of the opinion from page 955. This reasoning is in accord with the plain meaning of section 1983, which is captioned civil action for deprivation of rights and creates liability for the deprivation of any rights, privileges, or immunities of any citizen of the United States. Although there is language in the Supreme Court's opinion referring to personal injuries, and she cites Garcia, a fair reading of the decision suggests that where there is a choice between a statute governing bodily injury actions and one governing actions involving injuries to personal rights, the latter should prevail. The Wisconsin statute governing actions to damages for an injury to character or rights is more closely analogous to the spirit of section 1983 than is the statute governing personal injury actions. That's what Judge Crabb reads in 1985. And Mr. Modell is correct in saying that Judge Crabb was the first one to decide before the Gray decision, and then all the other federal courts came in and followed Gray. But it's interesting to read those other lower court federal opinions, because those other lower court federal opinions don't simply say, well, this issue has been decided by Gray and we're bound by case closed. They go through the reasoning. Okay, they actually, Judge Reynolds, Judge Evans, Judge Gordon, go through the reasoning. And they actually say, they talk about Hansen and basically say, yeah, the Seventh Circuit is right. Now, a few of you have been trial judges, and a trial judge, if it really doesn't think the higher court is quite on level plumb, can indicate as much in a decision. Or a trial court can just simply say, well, this issue is foreclosed, I don't want to even talk about it. All of those judges, okay, a cadre of fairly qualified individuals in this state, have looked at the reasoning and concluded that, indeed, 893.53 applies. And there's one other point I would like to underscore about the Gray opinion. The Gray opinion, on the panel, sat a Judge Coffey. That Judge Coffey is the same Justice Coffey of this court for a number of years, the same Judge Coffey that was a circuit court judge in Milwaukee County for even a longer period in time. He certainly is familiar with Wisconsin law. He certainly is also familiar, by virtue of his experience on the federal bench, with the federal law applicable. He was on the panel on Gray. He was on the panel that said 893.53 applies. So we have a significant body of precedent. And I do want to take issue with Mr. Modell's argument that if this court were to decide that 893.54 applies, the Seventh Circuit would be bound. That is wrong. That's wrong on the law. And in fact, the Wilson Court in Wilson, United States Supreme Court, the New Mexico Supreme Court had decided in Wilson earlier on that a particular statute of limitations applied for Section 1983. The Tenth Circuit in Wilson said, no, we don't agree with the New Mexico Supreme Court. We're going to apply our own statute of limitations. The United States Supreme Court concluded on page 270-271, so here, the federal interest in uniformity and the interest in firmly defined and easily applied rules support the conclusion that Congress intended the characterization of Section 1983 to be measured by federal rather than state standards. The Court of Appeals was therefore correct in concluding it was not bound by the New Mexico Supreme Court holding. The Seventh Circuit and the federal district courts can ignore this court's decision. And then what do you have? What you're going to have is you're going to have 3 years for state court actions, 6 years for federal court actions. Does that make any sense? Is that part of simple, uniform policy? Absolutely not. In fact, in Wilson, that was one of the issues that the Supreme Court used to decide what it did. In Wilson, what you had was courts characterizing various actions here and there as this and that and this statute of limitations, and there were multiple statutes of limitations applying depending upon how you characterize the action. That was the genesis, the underscoring of the court in Wilson, is to get rid of all that and apply one. Now what we're going to have in Wisconsin is we're going to have, if you sue in state court, it's three, and that's going to help pro se litigants? No. Let's talk for a moment.
Also, before we move into that, can you define for me what the word residual means?
I think it is defined, I think we did include it, if I recall.
I've been looking for it in your brief. I thought it was there, but I
know it's there. Okay, the only question is
it's
whether.
It's such a lengthy brief on such a question, I have a hard time finding.
Maybe if I look to the index, I can find it. Page 17.
Page 17. Oh, okay, yeah, there it is. Constituting the remainder.
Residue. Something that remains after a part was taken.
Right, I've always thought of it as those that are not enumerated are residual. Is that a fair...
I don't know. I'm not sure if that's an accurate rendition or not. But in terms of that question, can I go ahead and deal with that issue?
Let me get you where I'm...
Okay.
I don't want to hide the ball with you. What I'm thinking of is the word residual, to me, is always meant, you know, if I articulate quite a few things and some remain unarticulated, those are the residuaries,
right,
et cetera. And the point here, the point that has me somewhat concerned, you're not greatly concerned, but somewhat concerned, is that there are many statutes involving personal injuries that are articulated in the code, in the statutes. And therefore, why isn't this the residuary statute, the argument made by Mr. Moore?
Because, in essence, again, if you construe 89354 to be dealing with bodily injuries and be tailored mainly to that, which is what, indeed, the courts have construed it to be, then it really isn't a residual any more than a statute involving intentional tort is a residual, or a statute involving medical malpractice is a residual. And actually, in that sense, and I wanted to get to this, the legislative history actually, in a sense, supports our position. If you recall what the legislature thought injuries to the person meant, injuries to the person meant, at that time, under the holdings of this court, bodily injuries. What happened in 1957 was the legislature carved out the bodily injury section, carved it out, made it a separate three-year section. But what's left is, in fact, 89353, which is the residual. And the courts, in terms of construing 89353 and applying it, have applied it as a residual. In other words, if we can't find anything else that this fits under, then it fits under 89353. That was the reasoning of the Acharya Court for medical malpractice cases, legal malpractice cases. That was the reasoning of the Milwaukee Partners Court for engineering malpractice cases. That was the reasoning of the Siegel Court for talking about intentional interference with contractual rights and malicious prosecution. And I believe the Siegel Court mentioned the 89353 as being the residual statute. So in terms of the way the state courts have treated 89353, in terms of the legislative history, I think it's fairly clear that 89353 is the residual and is used as a residual in that reflect.
Does it read like a residual?
Does it read like a residual? 89353, I think the language at the very end does make it read like a residual, and that was one of the things that was emphasized by the Gray Court. And I'm looking for the last...
Except when there are different periods expressly prescribed or debarred.
Right. I think that makes it sound more like a residual statute. In other words, if it isn't pulled out and specified somewhere else, then you go to that. And in fact, the court in Gray did rely upon that reasoning to lay a foundation. Let me make a couple quick other points. The other interesting thing about this is that this action itself is not a bodily injury action, and a lot of Section 1983 cases don't involve bodily injuries whatsoever. They all involve, though, by definition, a deprivation of rights or injury to rights. Let's turn for a few minutes to the Hansen-Kemper decisions, because I think we need to take a careful look at those cases. In Hansen and in Kemper both, there's no mention by the court of 893.53. None. I went to the state law library and looked at the briefs in both those cases. There's no mention of 893.53 in the briefs. There's no mention of that at all. There's no consideration of 893.53. And then the question becomes, well, why not? Hansen was briefed a year before it was decided. Hansen was briefed before Wilson was decided. The argument in Hansen was all about whether a very general statute of limitations dealing with state causes of action, I believe it's 893.93, applied as opposed to a one-year Fair Labor Standards statute of limitations. That was the argument that was going back and forth. The issue of what was a personal injury statute of limitation was never briefed or argued by any of the parties. Wilson comes down in April of 1985. Then the court gets the briefs in about May of and decides it within 30 to 45 days after Wilson comes down, apparently without any briefing or discussion. And so the Court of Appeals simply applied 893.54 without any argument and without really analyzing what was rights versus personal injuries. Kemper was another case that was decided that same year. Again, that decision was made by the lower court before Wilson came down. Interestingly enough, in Kemper, there's no mention in the plaintiff's brief of Wilson, Hansen, or 893.53 or 893.54 at all. One of the defendants doesn't even mention it, and only one of the defendants alleged Hansen applied, but didn't really discuss it in any sort of detail, and the plaintiff in reply brief doesn't discuss any of it. And the reason why, in Kemper, the issue really was when the statute of limitations accrued. In Kemper, the person was a disabled person who was institutionalized and basically was deinstitutionalized in 1973. The action was brought, I believe, in 1984. Okay. Well, whether you apply 3, 6, or 10, okay, if it occurs in 1973, you're out. And the reply brief of the plaintiff in that case really focused on when this thing accrued. It didn't have anything to do with whether 3 or 6 or 10 or what applies. So you look at the vaunted precedent that defendants supply you, and it really isn't a precedent that really comes down and analyzes the issues. And really, unfortunately, and these things happen, unfortunately, the parties in their briefs and so on and so forth never really did address the issues. What you have on the other side of the coin, however, is the Seventh Circuit, two separate panel opinions, and several different opinions of district court judges which have analyzed the issues, and have analyzed the issues in light of the federal interest. So I think that it's fairly clear that the precedent and the reasoning of these cases strongly support the six-year statute as opposed to the three.
Counsel, let me...
Yes, sir.
If I may interrupt. Owen says general or residual. Your opposing counsel said that you, as opposing counsel, seems to agree that 54 is the general personal injury statute of limitation.
I don't agree.
Okay. I would say that a bit academically, because I certainly understood the prior 20
right.
minutes. To be a disagreement with that.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I don't agree. The courts have construed this and used this as a bodily injury. Let's get to the policies at issue, and we talked a little bit about that. What Mr. Modell argues extensively is that you want a broad statute of limitations because you don't want the legislature sneaking up and changing the statutes of limitations on you. The Supreme Court in Wilson did not say what you're supposed to do is count the numbers of civil actions that are filed under any statute of limitations and whichever greater wins. Okay, that is not the issue. The issue is it broad enough so that we're comfortable with it protecting the federal rights, that the legislature won't underhandedly change the statute of limitations and make it shorter. I don't think there should be a concern about that. We've got, as I listed them before, we've got certainly medical malpractice, or not, I keep saying medical, legal malpractice and professional malpractice cases which fall under 893-53. And I submit to this court, I think it's going to be a long time before the legislature shortens the time period for legal malpractice cases. I really do. And I think also with respect to intentional interference with contracts and some of the other things that are covered there, I don't think the legislature will change it. Moreover, the Gray opinion and the federal court's decisions under Gray have been around since 1989 and the early 90s. I have seen no movement by the state legislature to change 893-53 to shorten it. So I don't think their quote-unquote policy concern about making sure that you have a broad enough statute of limitations such that the legislature doesn't do anything sneaking underhanded here is relevant. I think 893-53 is broad enough to protect against that and broad enough to encompass the concern that was listed in Wilson. The only policy argument that really is important, I think, is in terms of consistency and uniformity, and I've already touched briefly a little bit on that, but to have two separate statutes of limitations here, one for federal court and one for state court, is just a nightmare. I mean, Section 1983 actions, as I'm sure you're all aware, are complicated enough, but to have a separate statute of limitations for one and a statute of limitations for another just makes absolutely no sense in terms of making things simple and making things easy for, quote, pro se litigants, unquote. The other thing that Mr. Mulder mentioned is ease of a pro se litigant looking and finding what the accurate statute of limitations is. And actually, if you do go to the book here and under tort actions, and you run down the list of what you would look at to apply, the first thing is injury for wrongful taking of personal property. Another is an action for damage to injury to property. And then you get to 893-53, which reads action for injury to character or other rights.
Says to the character or rights. You put in other.
No, I didn't. I'm looking at
that. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm looking at the book. It may be misbound or misprinted, but it says 893 action for injury to character or other rights. And then it reads action to recover damages for injury to character or other rights. And that's one of the things I wanted to comment about their brief that is inaccurate, and it's actually a mischaracterization of the statute and a misrepresentation of the statute. In their brief, what they talk about is 893-53 being, quote, character rights, and they put quotes around it. They put quotes around it as if that's the statutory language. That's not right. I mean, that's, in essence, a misrepresentation of the statute. The statute reads character or other rights.
What book are you reading?
When you look at the actual printed book.
I'm looking at that, but it must have been amended. I'm looking at 95, 96. It doesn't say other.
Well, all I can say is that this is 95, 96. Character or other rights. And the language of the statute reads, an action to recover injury for damages or an injury to the character or rights of another. Okay, the language itself does. But the heading says character or other rights.
Headings don't count. Read 990.
Okay. Well, what we were talking about, though, is a person. I'm sorry, Ryan, but what we were talking about is a pro se litigant going down the chapters and trying to figure out which one applied. And it does say, in terms of the language, it says character or rights of another. So, I mean, I think, given that the argument in terms of simplicity, I think favors 893-53 strongly in that respect. Let me check my notes. I don't think I have much further unless the court has further questions for me. As I said, I think the issue before the court, once it's understood that what the Supreme Court was concerned about, in the essence of 1983 actions, was an injury to rights and an injury to personal rights. And then once you look at what has been done with 893-54, and that is mainly a bodily injury statute, the two are not the same. And that the bodily injury statute really is a subsection of a more general injury to the rights of another section. And therefore, the longer statute, 6 years, 893-53, I think it's clear under the federal standards as applied, I think it's clear under the federal policy as applied, and I think it's clear from the language of the statutes itself that the 6 year 893-53 applies. And then you take a look at the weight of the precedent in terms of the courts that have actually analyzed and looked at this case. I think it's clear that 893-53, the 6 year statute of limitations, applies in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Modell.
Wilson v. Garcia. This is what the Supreme Court said. The characterization of all Section 1983 actions as involving claims for personal injuries minimizes the risk that the choice of a state statute of limitations would not fairly serve the federal interests vindicated by Section 1983. General personal injury actions, sounding in tort, constitute a major part of the total volume of civil litigation in the state courts today, probably did so in 1871 when Section 1983 was enacted. The Supreme Court in Wilson is not attempting, as plaintiff's counsel would suggest, to come up with a statute of limitation that's in the nature of a Section 1983 claim. They're attempting to find a statute of limitation which can be broadly applied. That's what the language there states. It's not looking for a violation of rights. It's looking for what's the statute of limitation that's easily understandable. That would be a personal injury statute of limitation.
Would you agree that 54 is a bodily injury statute?
Yes, I would agree with that. And a bodily injury including emotional distress type damages as well.
And do you agree that the term personal injury can be broader than bodily injury?
I don't believe that the United States Supreme Court, neither Wilson or Owens, or in our state statute 893.54, intended something much broader.
So you equate, in Wilson, personal injury to bodily injury?
Yes, Your Honor. I do. And that's consistent with what the Wilson court was attempting to do.
Since you have Wilson there, your opposing counsel made reference to page 270, 271, and indicated the Court of Appeals was therefore correct in concluding that it was not bound by the New Mexico Supreme Court holding in De Vargas. And that language was cited for the consistency argument. He suggested that perhaps you missed stated when you said that there wouldn't be a lack of consistency between the federal court and the state court. Can you respond to this language and his argument citing this language?
Sure, Your Honor. There is no question, and it was the first issue that the Wilson court addressed, what law applies in characterizing a Section 1983 claim. And federal law applies in characterizing it. And that's what the Supreme Court held. That was their very first issue they addressed. And that's not the issue that's being argued here. And here we're talking about personal injury is what has been determined that all Section 1983 actions should be characterized as for statute of limitation purposes. And now the question is, which statute of limitation in Wisconsin? Is Wisconsin's personal injury general or residual statute of limitation? That's not a federal issue. The characterization of the claim as a personal injury is indeed a federal characterization, and that's what the Supreme Court said. But we cited to the court the Soderbeck case on an issue that's purely Wisconsin law, interpreting which of those statutes of Wisconsin statutes of limitation is a personal injury, general statute of limitation, or residual statute of limitation. That is a state question.
That is a question under Soderbeck that the federal courts are going to be bound by the state's determination. I don't think there's any question about that. That is not characterizing the particular claim. We're not characterizing whether it's personal injury or not. The Supreme Court has done that. The whole basis of the plaintiff's argument here to this court is that this is not a bodily injury, that these violations of rights are something other than bodily injury, and therefore point 54 should not apply. Again, that is exactly contrary to what the United States Supreme Court was attempting to accomplish both in Wilson and in Owens. If it had been simply, if I may just finish.
Yes, you may.
If it had just been simply, how do we characterize these rights, it would have been a much different decision. We know in Wilson exactly what the United States Supreme Court wanted to get away from was having the rights under Section 1983 characterized, the limitation period characterized close to the nature of the right. That's what caused the confusion, and that's what the plaintiff is asking this court to go back to. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goldberg. The court is in recess until December 15th for oral arguments.